Chapter 4. As Frank Frink watched his ex-employer waddle down the corridor and into the main work area of WM Corporation, he thought to himself, "The strange thing about Wyndham Matson is that he does not look like a man who owns a factory. He looks like a tenderloin bum, a wino, who has been given a bath, new clothes, a shave, haircut, shot of vitamins, and set out into the world with $5 to find a new life." The old man had a weak, shifty, nervous, even ingratiating manner, as if he regarded everyone as a potential enemy stronger than he, whom he had to fawn on and pacify. "They're going to get me," his manner seemed to say. And yet, old W.M. was really very powerful. He owned controlling interests in a variety of enterprises, speculations, real estate, as well as the W.M. Corporation factory. Following after the old man, Frink pushed open the big metal door to the main work area. The rumble of machinery, which he had heard around him every day for so long, sight of men at the machines, air filled with flash of light, waste dust, movement. There went the old man. Frink increased his pace.
"Hey, Mr. W.M.," he called.
The old man had stopped by the hairy-armed shop foreman, Ed McCarthy. Both of them glanced up as Frink came toward them. Moistening his lips nervously, Wyndham Manson said,
"I'm sorry, Frank. I can't do anything about taking you back. I've already gone ahead and hired someone to take your place, thinking you weren't coming back, after what you said."
His small round eyes flickered with what Frink knew to be an almost hereditary evasiveness. It was in the old man's blood. Frink said, "I came for my tools, nothing else." His own voice, he was glad to hear, was firm, even harsh.
"Well, let's see,"
W.M. mumbled, obviously hazy in his own mind as to the status of Frink's tools. To Ed McCarthy, he said,
"I think that would be in your department, Ed. Maybe you can fix Frank here up. I have other business."
He glanced at his pocket watch.
"Listen, Ed, I'll discuss that invoice later. I have to run along."
He patted Ed McCarthy on the arm and then trotted off, not looking back. Ed McCarthy and Frink stood together.
"You came to get your job back," McCarthy said after a time.
"Yes," Frink said. "I was proud of what you said yesterday."
"So was I," Frink said.
"But, Christ, I can't work it out anywhere else."
He felt defeated and hopeless. "You know that." The two of them had, in the past, often talked over their problems. McCarthy said,
"I don't know that. You're as good with that flex cable machine as anybody on the coast. I've seen you whip out a piece in 5 minutes, including the rouge polishing, all the way from the rough cradex, and except for the welding."
"I never said I could weld," Frink said.
"Did you ever think of going into business on your own?"
Frink, taken by surprise, stammered,
"What's doing?"
"Jewelry."
"Ah, for Christ's sake."
"Custom original pieces, not commercial."
McCarthy beckoned him over to a corner of the shop, away from the noise. "For about $2,000 you could set up a little basement or garage shop. One time I drew up designs for women's earrings and pendants. You remember, real modern contemporary."
Taking scratch paper, he began to draw, slowly, grimly.
Peering over his shoulder, Frink saw a bracelet design, an abstract with flowing lines.
"Is there a market?"
All he had ever seen were the traditional, even antique, objects from the past.
"Nobody wants contemporary American. There isn't any such thing, not since the war."
"Create a market,"
McCarthy said with an angry grimace.
"You mean sell it myself?"
"Take it into retail shops, like that, what's it called, on Montgomery Street, that big ritzy art object place."
"American artistic handcrafts,"
Frink said. He never went into fashionable, expensive stores such as that. Few Americans did. It was the Japanese who had the money to buy from such places.
"You know what retailers like that are selling?"
McCarthy said.
"And getting a fortune for? Those goddamn silver belt buckles from New Mexico that the Indians make. Those goddamn tourist trash pieces all alike. Supposedly native art."
For a long time, Frink regarded McCarthy.
"I know what else they sell,"
he said finally.
"And so do you."
"Yes,"
McCarthy said. They both knew, because they had both been directly involved, and for a long time. WM Corporation's stated legal business consisted in turning out wrought iron staircases, railings, fireplaces, and ornaments for new apartment buildings, all on a mass basis from standard designs. For a new 40-unit building, the same piece would be executed 40 times in a row. Ostensibly, WM Corporation was an iron foundry. But, in addition, it maintained another business, from which its real profits were derived. Using an elaborate variety of tools, materials, and machines, WM Corporation turned out a constant flow of forgeries of pre-war American artifacts. These forgeries were cautiously but expertly fed into the wholesale art object market to join the genuine objects collected throughout the continent. As in the stamp and coin business, no one could possibly estimate the percentage of forgeries in circulation. And no one, especially the dealers and the collectors themselves, wanted to. When Frink had quit, there lay half-finished on his bench a Colt revolver of the frontier period. He had made the molds himself, done the casting, and had been busy hand-smoothing the pieces. There was an unlimited market for small arms of the American Civil War in frontier period. WM Corporation could sell all that Frink could turn out. It was his specialty. Walking slowly over to his bench, Frink picked up the still rough and burred ramrod of the revolver. Another 3 days and the gun would be finished. Yes, he thought, it was good work. An expert could have told the difference, but the Japanese collectors weren't authorities in the proper sense, had no standards or tests by which to judge. In fact, as far as he knew, it had never occurred to them to ask themselves if the so-called historic art objects for sale in West Coast shops were genuine. Perhaps someday they would, and then the bubble would burst, the market would collapse even for the authentic pieces. A Gresham's Law, the fakes would undermine the value of the real. And that, no doubt, was the motive for the failure to investigate. After all, everyone was happy. The factories, here and there in the various cities, which turned out the pieces, they made their profits. The wholesalers passed them on, and the dealers displayed and advertised them. The collectors shelled out their money and carried their purchases happily home, to impress their associates, friends, and mistresses. Like post-war boodle paper money, it was fine until questioned. Nobody was hurt, until the day of reckoning. And then everyone equally would be ruined. But meanwhile, nobody talked about it. Even the men who earned their living turning out the forgeries, they shut their own minds to what they made, kept their attention on the mere technical problems. "How long since you tried to do original designing?" McCarthy asked. Frink shrugged. "Years. I can copy accurately as hell, but..." "You know what I think? I think you've picked up the Nazi idea that Jews can't create, that they can only imitate and sell. Middlemen." He fixed his merciless scrutiny on Frink. "Maybe so," Frink said. "Try it. Do some original designs, or work directly on the metal. Play around, like a kid plays." "No," Frink said. "You have no faith," McCarthy said. "You've completely lost faith in yourself, right? Too bad, because I know you could do it." He walked away from the workbench. "It is too bad," Frink thought. "But nevertheless, it's the truth. It's a fact. I can't get faith or enthusiasm by willing it, deciding to." That McCarthy, he thought, is a damn good shop foreman. He has the knack of needling a man, getting him to put out his best efforts, to do his utmost in spite of himself. He's a natural leader. He almost inspired me for a moment there. But McCarthy had gone off now. The effort had failed. "Too bad I don't have my copy of the Oracle here," Frink thought. "I could consult it on this, take the issue to it for his 5,000 years of wisdom." And then he recalled that there was a copy of the I Ching in the lounge of the business office of WM Corporation. So he made his way from the work area, along the corridor, hurriedly through the business office to the lounge. Seated in one of the chrome and plastic lounge chairs, he wrote his question out on the back of an envelope. "Should I attempt to go into the creative private business outlined to me just now?" And then he began throwing the coins. The bottom line was a 7, and so was the second, and then the third. The bottom trigram in Qian, he realized. That sounded good. Qian was the creative. Then line 4, an 8, Yin, and line 5, also 8, a Yin line. "Good Lord," he thought excitedly. "One more Yin line, and I've got hexagram 11, Tai, peace." Very favorable judgment. Or, his hands trembled as he rattled the coins, a Yang line, and hence hexagram 26, Ta Chu, the taming power of the great. Both have favorable judgments, and it has to be one or the other. He threw the 3 coins. Yin, a 6. It was peace. Opening the book, he read the judgment. peace, the small departs, the great approaches, good fortune, success. So I ought to do as Ed McCarthy says, open my little business. Now the six at the top, my one moving line, he turned the page. What was the text? He could not recall, probably favorable because the hexagram itself was so favorable. Union of heaven and earth. But the first and last lines were outside the hexagram always, so possibly the six at the top. His eyes picked out the line, read it in a flash. The wall falls back into the moat. Use no army now. Make your commands known within your own town. Perseverance brings humiliation.
My busted back! He exclaimed, horrified.
And the commentary. The change alluded to in the middle of the hexagram has begun to take place. The wall of the town sinks back into the moat from which it was dug. The hour of doom is at hand. It was, beyond doubt, one of the most dismal lines in the entire book, of more than 3,000 lines. And yet the judgment of the hexagram was good. Which was he supposed to follow? And how could they be so different? It had never happened to him before. Good fortune and doom mixed together in the oracle's prophecy. What a weird fate! As if the oracle had scraped the bottom of the barrel, tossed up every sort of rag, bone, and turd of the dark, then reversed itself and poured in the light like a cook gone barmy. I must have pressed two buttons at once, he decided. Jammed the works and got this Schlemazel's eye view of reality. Just for a second, fortunately. Didn't last. Hell, he thought, it has to be one or the other. It can't be both. You can't have good fortune and doom simultaneously. Or can you? The jewelry business will bring good fortune. The judgment refers to that. But the line, the goddamn line, it refers to something deeper, some future catastrophe, probably not even connected with the jewelry business, some evil fate that's in store for me anyhow. War, he thought. Third World War. All frigging 2 billion of us killed. Our civilization wiped out. Hydrogen bombs falling like hail. My gavalt, he thought. What's happening? Did I start it in motion? Or is someone else tinkering? Someone I don't even know? Or the whole lot of us? It's the fault of those physicists and that synchronicity theory, every particle being connected with every other. You can't fart without changing the balance in the universe. It makes living a funny joke with nobody around to laugh. I open a book and get a report on future events that even God would like to file and forget. And who am I? The wrong person, I can tell you that. I should take my tools, get my motors from McCarthy, open my shop, start my piddling business, go on despite the horrible line. Be working, creating in my own way, right up to the end, living as best I can, as actively as possible, until the wall falls back into the moat for all of us, all mankind. That's what the oracle is telling me. Fate will pull Axis eventually anyhow, but I have my job in the meantime. I must use my mind, my hands. The judgment was for me alone, for my work. But the line, it was for us all. I'm too small, he thought. I can only read what's written, glance up, and then lower my head and plod along where I left off, as if I hadn't seen. The oracle doesn't expect me to start running up and down the streets, squalling and yammering for public attention. Can anyone alter it? He wondered. All of us combined, or one great figure, or someone strategically placed, who happens to be in the right spot. Chance. Accident. And our lives, our world, hanging on it. Closing the book, he left the lounge and walked back to the main work area. When he caught sight of McCarthy, he waved him over to one side where they could resume talk.
The more I think about it, Frink said, the more I like your idea.
Fine, McCarthy said. Now listen, here's what you do. You have to get money from Wyndham Matson. He winked, a slow, intense, frightened twitch of his eyelid.
I figured out how. I'm going to quit and go in with you. My design, see? What's wrong with that? I know they're good.
Sure, Frank said, a little dazed.
I'll see you after work tonight, McCarthy said, at my apartment. You come over around 7 and have dinner with Jean and me, if you can stand the kids.
Okay, Frank said. McCarthy gave him a slap on the shoulder and went off. I've gone a long way, Frank said to himself, in the last 10 minutes. But he did not feel apprehensive. He felt, now, excitement. It sure happened fast, he thought as he walked over to his bench and began collecting his tools. I guess that's how those kinds of things happen. Opportunity, when it comes. All my life I've waited for this.
When the oracle says something must be achieved, it means this. The time is truly great. What is the time now? What is this moment?
6 at the top in hexagram 11 changes everything to 26, taming power of the great. Yin becomes yang. The line moves and a new moment appears. And I was so off stride I didn't even notice.
I'll bet that's why I got that terrible line. That's the only way hexagram 11 can change to hexagram 26, by that moving 6 at the top. So I shouldn't get my ass in such an uproar.
But despite his excitement and optimism, he could not get the line completely out of his mind.
However, he thought ironically, I'm making a damn good try. By 7 tonight, maybe I'll have managed to forget it like it never happened.
He thought, I sure hope so, because this get-together with Ed is big. He's got some surefire idea, I can tell, and I don't intend to find myself left out. Right now I'm nothing, but if I can swing this, then maybe I can get Juliana back. I know what she wants. She deserves to be married to a man who matters, an important person in the community, not some meshuggah. Men used to be men in the old days, before the war, for instance, but all that's gone now. No wonder she roams around from place to place, from man to man, seeking, and not even knowing what it is herself, what her biology needs. But I know, and through this big-time action with McCarthy, whatever it is, I'm going to achieve it for her.
At lunchtime, Robert Childen closed up American Artistic Handcrafts, Inc. Usually he crossed the street and ate at the coffee shop. In any case, he stayed away no more than half an hour, and today he was gone only 20 minutes. Memory of his ordeal with Mr. Tagomi and the staff of the trade mission still kept his stomach upset. As he returned to his store, he said to himself, "Perhaps new policy of not making calls. Do all business within store." 2 hours showing, much too long, almost 4 hours in all, too late to reopen store. An entire afternoon to sell one item, one Mickey Mouse watch, expensive treasure, but... He unlocked the store door, propped it open, went to hang up his coat in the rear. When he re-emerged, he found that he had a customer, a white man. Well, he thought, surprise.
"Good day, sir,"
Sheldon said, bowing slightly. Probably a Pinnock, slender, rather dark man, well-dressed, fashionable, but not at ease, slight shine of perspiration.
"Good day," the man murmured, moving around the store to inspect the displays. Then, all at once, he approached the counter. He reached into his coat, produced a small, shiny leather card case, set down a multicolored, elaborately printed card. On the card, the imperial emblem and military insignia, the Navy, Admiral Harusha. Robert Sheldon examined it, impressed.
"The Admiral's ship," the customer explained, "lies in San Francisco Bay at this moment. The carrier, Siokaku."
"Ah,"
Sheldon said. "Admiral Harusha has never before visited the West Coast," the customer explained. "He has many wishes while here, one of which is to pay personal visit to your famous store. All the time in the home islands he has heard of American Artistic Handcrafts, Incorporated."
Sheldon bowed with delight.
"However," the man continued, "due to pressure of appointments, the Admiral cannot pay personal visit to your esteemed store, but he has sent me. I am his gentleman."
"The Admiral is a collector?"
Sheldon said, his mind working at top speed.
"He is a lover of the arts. He is a connoisseur, but not a collector. What he desires is for gift purposes. To wit, he wishes to present each officer of his ship a valuable historic artifact, a sidearm of the epic American Civil War."
The man paused. "There are 12 officers in all." To himself, Sheldon thought, 12 Civil War sidearms. Cost to buyer almost $10,000. He trembled.
"As is well known," the man continued, "your shop sells such priceless antique artifacts from the pages of American history, alas, all too rapidly vanishing into limbo of time."
Taking enormous care in his words, he could not afford to lose this, to make one single slip. Sheldon said,
"Yes, it is true. Of all the stores in PSA, I possess finest stock imaginable of Civil War weapons. I will be happy to serve Admiral Harusha. Shall I gather a superb collection of such and bring aboard the Siokaku? This afternoon, possibly?"
The man said,
"No, I shall inspect them here."
12, Sheldon computed. He did not possess 12, in fact he had only 3, but he could acquire 12, if luck were with him, through various channels within the week.
Air Express from the East, for instance, and local wholesale contacts.
You, sir, Sheldon said, are knowledgeable in such weapons?
Tolerably, the man said. I have a small collection of hand weapons, including tiny secret pistol made to look like domino, circa 1840.
Exquisite item, Sheldon said, as he went to the locked safe to get several guns for Admiral Harush's gentleman's inspection.
When he returned, he found the man writing out a bank check. The man paused and said,
The Admiral desires to pay in advance, a deposit of 15,000 PSA dollars.
The room swam before Children's eyes, but he managed to keep his voice level. He even made himself sound a trifle bored.
If you wish, it is not necessary, a mere formality of business.
Laying down a leather and felt box, he said,
Here is exceptional Colt 44 of 1860.
He opened the box.
Black powder and ball. This issued to U.S. Army. Boys in blue carried these into, for instance, Second Bull Run.
For a considerable time, the man examined the Colt 44. Then, lifting his eyes, he said calmly,
Sir, this is an imitation.
Eh?
Sheldon said, not comprehending.
This piece is no older than 6 months, so your offering is a fake. I am cast into gloom. But see, the wood here, artificially aged by an acid chemical. What a shame.
He laid the gun down. Sheldon picked the gun up and stood holding it between his hands. He could think of nothing to say. Turning the gun over and over, he said at last,
It can't be.
An imitation of the authentic historic gun. Nothing more. I am afraid, sir, you have been deceived. Perhaps by some unscrupulous churl. You must report this to the San Francisco police.
The man bowed.
It grieves me. You may have other imitations, too, in your shop. Is it possible, sir, that you, the owner, dealer in such items, cannot distinguish the forgeries from the real?
There was silence. Reaching down, the man picked up the half-completed check which he had been making out. He returned it to his pocket, put his pen away, and bowed.
It is a shame, sir, but I clearly cannot, alas, conduct my business with American Artistic Handcrafts Incorporated, after all. Admiral Harusho will be disappointed. Nevertheless, you can see my position.
Children stared down at the gun.
Good day, sir, the man said. Please accept my humbly meant advice. Hire some expert to scrutinize your acquisitions, your reputation. I am sure you understand.
Sheldon mumbled.
Sir, if you could please...
Be tranquil, sir. I will not mention this to anyone. I shall tell the Admiral that unfortunately your shop was closed today. After all...
The man paused at the doorway.
We are both, after all, white men.
Bowing once more, he departed. Alone, Sheldon stood holding the gun. It can't be, he thought. But it must be. Good God in heaven, I am ruined. I have lost a $15,000 sale. And my reputation, if this gets out, if that man, Admiral Harush's gentleman, is not discreet... I will kill myself, he decided. I have lost place. I cannot go on. That is a fact. On the other hand, perhaps that man erred. Perhaps he lied. He was sent by United States Historic Objects to destroy me, or by West Coast Art Exclusives. Anyhow, one of my competitors. The gun is no doubt genuine. How can I find out? Sheldon racked his brains. Ah, I will have the gun analyzed at the University of California Penology Department. I know someone there, or at least I once did. This matter came up before once. Alleged non-authenticity of ancient breech-loader. In haste, he telephoned one of the city's bonded messenger and delivery services, told them to send a man over at once. Then he wrapped the gun and wrote out a note to the university lab, telling them to make professional estimate of the gun's age at once and inform him by phone. The delivery man arrived. Sheldon gave him the note and parcel, the address, and told him to go by helicopter. The man departed, and Sheldon began pacing about his store, waiting, waiting. At 3 o'clock, the university called.
Mr. Sheldon, the voice said, you wanted this weapon tested for authenticity, this 1860 Army Model Colt 44.
A pause while Sheldon gripped the phone with apprehension.
Here's the lab report. It's a reproduction cast from plastic molds, except for the walnut. Serial numbers all wrong.
the frame not case-hardened by the cyanide process. Both brown and blue surfaces, achieved by a modern quick-acting technique, the whole gun artificially aged, given a treatment to make it appear old and worn. Chilton said thickly,
"The man who brought it to me for appraisal..."
"Tell him he's been taken," the university technician said. "And very taken. It's a good job, done by a real pro. See, the authentic gun was given its, you know, the blue metal parts. Those were put in a box of leather strips, sealed with cyanide gas and heated. Too cumbersome nowadays. But this was done in a fairly well-equipped shop. We detected particles of several polishing and finishing compounds, some quite unusual. Now, we can't prove this, but we know there's a regular industry turning out these fakes. There must be. We've seen so many."
"No," Chilton said. "That is only a rumor. I can state that to you as absolute fact, sir."
His voice rose and broke screechingly.
"And I am in a position to know. Why do you think I sent it to you? I could perceive its fakery, being qualified by years of training. Such as this is a rarity, an oddity. Actually, a joke, a prank."
He broke off, panting.
"Thank you for confirming my own observations. You will bill me. Thank you."
He rang off at once. Then, without pausing, he got out his records. He began tracing the gun. How had it come to him? From whom? It had come, he discovered, from one of the largest wholesale suppliers in San Francisco, Ray Calvin Associates, on Van Ness. At once he phoned them.
"Let me talk to Mr. Calvin," he said.
His voice had now become a trifle steadier. Presently, a gruff voice, very busy.
"Yes?" "This is Bob Chilton, at AAH Inc. on Montgomery. Ray, I have a matter of delicacy. I wish to see you. Private conference. Sometime today in your office, or etc. Believe me, sir, you had better heed my request."
Now he discovered he was bellowing into the phone.
"Okay,"
Ray Calvin said.
"Tell no one. This is absolutely confidential."
4 o'clock.
4 it is, Chilton said. At your office. Good day.
He slammed the receiver down so furiously that the entire phone fell from the counter to the floor. Kneeling, he gathered it up and replaced it in its spot. There was half an hour ahead before he should start. He had all that time to pace, helpless, waiting. What to do? An idea. He phoned the San Francisco office of the Tokyo Herald on Market Street.
"Sirs," he said, "please tell me if the carrier Siakaku is in the harbor, and if so, how long. I would appreciate this information from your estimable newspaper."
An agonizing wait. Then the girl was back.
"According to our reference room, sir," she said in a giggling voice, "the Carrio Siakaku is at the bottom of the Philippine Sea. It was sunk by an American submarine in 1945. Any more questions we can help you with, sir?"
Obviously they, at the newspaper office, appreciated the wild goose variety of prank that had been played on him. He hung up. No Carrio Siakaku for 17 years. Probably no Admiral Harusha. The man had been an impostor. And yet, the man had been right. The Colt 44 was a fake. It did not make sense. Perhaps the man was a speculator. He had been trying to corner the market in Civil War period sidearms. An expert. And he had recognized the fake. He was the professional of professionals. It would take a professional to know. Someone in the business. Not a mere collector. Chilton felt a tiny measure of relief. Then few others would detect, perhaps no one else. Secret safe. Let matter drop? He considered. No, must investigate. First of all, get back investment, get reimbursement from Ray Calvin, and must have all other artifacts in stock examined by university lab. But suppose many of them are non-authentic. Difficult matter. Only way is this, he decided. He felt grim, even desperate. Go to Ray Calvin, confront him, insist that he pursue matter back to source. Maybe he is innocent, too. Maybe not. In any case, tell him no more fakes or I will not buy through him ever again. He will have to absorb the loss, Chilton decided, not I. If he will not, then I will approach other retail dealers, tell them, ruin his reputation. Why should I be ruined alone? Pass it on to those responsible, hand hot potato back along line. But it must be done with utmost secrecy. Keep matter strictly between ourselves. Chapter 5. The telephone call from Ray Calvin puzzled Wyndham Matson. He could not make sense out of it, partly because of Calvin's rapid manner of speech, and partly because at the moment the call came, 11:30 in the evening, Wyndham Matson was entertaining a lady visitor in his apartment at the Miramichi Hotel. Calvin said,
"Look here, my friend, we're sending back that whole last shipment from you people, and I'd send back stuff before that, but we paid for everything except the last shipment. Your billing date, May 18th.
Naturally, Wyndham Matson wanted to know why.
"They're lousy fakes," Calvin said.
"But you knew that."
He was dumbfounded. "I mean, Ray, you've always been aware of the situation." He glanced around. The girl was off somewhere, probably in the powder room. Calvin said,
"I knew they were fakes. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the lousy part. Look, I'm really not concerned whether some gun you send us really was used in the Civil War or not. All I care about is that it's a satisfactory Colt 44, item whatever it is in your catalog. It has to meet standards. Look, do you know who Robert Sheldon is?"
"Yes."
He had a vague memory, although at the moment he could not quite pin the name down. Somebody important.
"He was in here today, to my office. I'm calling from my office, not home. We're still going over it. Anyhow, he came in and rattled off some long account. He was mad as hell, really agitated. Well, evidently some big customer of his, some Jap admiral, came in or had his man come in. Sheldon talked about a $20,000 order, but that's probably an exaggeration. Anyhow, what did happen, I have no cause to doubt this part, is that the Japanese came in, wanted to buy, took one look at one of those Colt 44 items you people turn out, saw it to be a fake, put his money back in his pants pocket and left. Now, what do you say?"
There was nothing that Wyndham Matson could think of to say, but he thought to himself instantly, "It's Frank and McCarthy. They said they'd do something, and this is it." But he could not figure out what they had done. He could not make sense out of Calvin's account. A kind of superstitious fright filled him. Those two, how could they doctor an item made last February? He had presumed they would go to the police or the newspapers or even the Pinnock government at SAC, and of course he had all those taken care of. Eerie. He did not know what to tell Calvin. He mumbled on for what seemed an endless time and at last managed to wind up the conversation and get off the phone. When he hung up, he realized with a start that Rita had come out of the bathroom and had listened to the whole conversation. She had been pacing irritably back and forth, wearing only a black silk slip, her blonde hair falling loosely over her bare, slightly freckled shoulders.
"Tell the police,"
she said. Well, he thought, it probably would be cheaper to offer them $2,000 or so. They'd accept it. That was probably all they wanted. Little fellows like that thought small. To them it would seem like a lot. They'd put in their new business, lose it, be broke again inside a month.
"No," he said. "Why not? Blackmail's a crime."
It was hard to explain to her. He was accustomed to paying people. It was part of the overhead, like the utilities, if the sum was small enough. But she did have a point. He mulled it over. "I'll give them $2,000, but I'll also get in touch with that guy at the Civic Center I know, that police inspector. I'll have them look into both Frink and McCarthy and see if there's anything of use. So if they come back and try again, I'll be able to handle them. For instance," he thought, "somebody told me Frink's a kike, changed his nose and name. All I have to do is notify the German consul here. Routine business. He'll request the Jap authorities for extradition. They'll gas the bugger as soon as they get him across the demarcation line. I think they've got one of those camps in New York," he thought, "those oven camps."
"I'm surprised," the girl said, "that anyone could blackmail a man of your stature."
She eyed him.
"Well, I'll tell you," he said, "this whole damn historicity business is nonsense. Those Japs are bats. I'll prove it."
Getting up, he hurried into his study, returned at once with two cigarette lighters, which he set down on the coffee table.
"Look at these. Look the same, don't they? Well, listen, one has historicity in it."
He grinned at her.
"Pick them up. Go ahead. One's worth, oh, maybe $40,000 or $50,000 on the collector's market."
The girl gingerly picked up the two lighters and examined them.
"Don't you feel it?" he kidded her. "The historicity?"
She said,
"What is historicity?" "When a thing has history in it. Listen, one of those two Zippo lighters was in Franklin D. Roosevelt's pocket when he was assassinated, and one wasn't. One has historicity. A hell of a lot of it. As much as any object ever had. And one has nothing. Can you feel it?"
He nudged her.
"You can't. You can't tell which is which. There's no mystical plasmic presence, no aura around it.
Gee, the girl said, awed.
Is that really true, that he had one of those on him that day?
Sure, and I know which it is. You see my point. It's all a big racket. They're playing it on themselves. I mean, a gun goes through a famous battle like the Meuse-Argonne, and it's the same as if it hadn't, unless you know.
It's in here, he tapped his head. In the mind, not the gun. I used to be a collector. In fact, that's how I got into this business. I collected stamps, early British colonies.
The girl now stood at the window, her arms folded, gazing out at the lights of downtown San Francisco.
My mother and dad used to say we wouldn't have lost the war if he had lived, she said.
Okay, Wyndham Manson went on. Now suppose, say, last year the Canadian government, or somebody, anybody, finds the plates from which some old stamp was printed, and the ink, and a supply of...
I don't believe either of those two lighters belonged to Franklin Roosevelt, the girl said.
Wyndham Matson giggled.
That's my point. I'd have to prove it to you with some sort of document, a paper of authenticity. And so it's all a fake, a mass delusion. The paper proves its worth, not the object itself.
Show me the paper.
Sure.
Hopping up, he made his way back into the study. From the wall, he took the Smithsonian Institution's framed certificate. The paper and the lighter had cost him a fortune, but they were worth it, because they enabled him to prove that he was right, that the word fake meant nothing really, since the word authentic meant nothing really.
A Colt 44 is a Colt 44,
he called to the girl as he hurried back into the living room.
It has to do with bore and design, not when it was made. It has to do with...
She held out her hand. He gave her the document.
So it is genuine, she said finally.
Yes, this one.
He picked up the lighter with a long scratch across its side.
I think I'd like to go now, the girl said. I'll see you again some other evening.
She set down the document and lighter and moved toward the bedroom where her clothes were.
Why? He shouted in agitation, following after her. You know it's perfectly safe. My wife won't be back for weeks. I explained the whole situation to you. A detached retina.
It's not that.
What then?
Rita said,
Please call a pedicab for me while I dress.
I'll drive you home, he said grumpily.
She dressed, and then, while he got her coat from the closet, she wandered silently about the apartment. She seemed pensive, withdrawn, even a little depressed. The past makes people sad, he realized. Damn it, why did I have to bring it up? But hell, she's so young. I thought she'd hardly know the name. At the bookcase she knelt.
Did you read this?
She asked, taking a book out. Nearsightedly he peered. Lurid cover, novel.
No, he said. My wife got that. She reads a lot.
You should read it.
Still feeling disappointed, he grabbed the book, glanced at it. The Grasshopper Lies Heavy.
Isn't this one of those banned in Boston books?
He said.
Banned through the United States, and in Europe, of course.
She had gone to the hall door and stood there now, waiting.
I have heard of this Hawthorne Abinson.
But actually he had not. All he could recall about the book was, what? That it was very popular right now. Another fad, another mass craze. He bent down and stuck it back on the shelf.
I don't have time to read popular fiction. I'm too busy with work.
Secretaries, he thought acidly, read that junk, at home alone in bed at night. It stimulates them, instead of the real thing, which they're afraid of, but of course really crave.
One of those love stories,
he said as he sullenly opened the hall door.
No, she said, a story about war.
As they walked down the hall to the elevator, she said,
He says the same thing as my mother and dad.
Who? That Abbotson?
That's his theory. If Joe Zangara had missed him, he would have pulled America out of the Depression and armed it so that...
She broke off. They arrived at the elevator, and other people were waiting. Later, as they drove through the nocturnal traffic in Wyndham Matson's Mercedes-Benz, she resumed.
Abinson's theory is that Roosevelt would have been a terribly strong president, as strong as Lincoln. He showed it in the year he was president, all those measures he introduced. The book is fiction. I mean, it's in novel form. Roosevelt isn't assassinated in Miami. He goes on and is reelected in 1936, so he's president until 1940, until during the war. Don't you see? He's still president when Germany attacks England and France and Poland. And he sees all that. He makes America strong. Garner was a really awful president. A lot of what happened was his fault. And then in 1940, instead of Bricker, a Democrat would have been elected.
According to this, Abelson,
Wyndham Matson broke in. He glanced at the girl beside him. God, they read a book, he thought, and they spout on forever.
His theory is that instead of an isolationist like Bricker, in 1940, after Roosevelt, Rexford Tugwell would have been president.
Her smooth face, reflecting the traffic lights, glowed with animation. Her eyes had become large, and she gestured as she talked.
And he would have been very active in continuing the Roosevelt anti-Nazi policies. So Germany would have been afraid to come to Japan's help in 1941. They would not have honored their treaty, do you see?
Turning toward him on the seat, grabbing his shoulder with intensity, she said,
"And so Germany and Japan would have lost the war."
He laughed. Staring at him, seeking something in his face, he could not tell what, and anyhow he had to watch the other cars, she said,
"It's not funny. It really would have been like that. The U.S. would have been able to lick the Japanese, and..."
"How?" he broke in.
"He has it all laid out."
For a moment she was silent.
"It's in fiction form," she said. "Naturally, it's got a lot of fictional parts. I mean, it's got to be entertaining, or people wouldn't read it. It has a human interest theme. There are these two young people, the boys in the American Army, the girl... Well, anyhow, President Tugwell is really smart. He understands what the Japs are going to do."
Anxiously, she said,
"It's all right to talk about this. The Japs have let it be circulated in the Pacific. I read that a lot of them are reading it. It's popular in the home islands. It stirred up a lot of talk."
Wyndham Matson said,
"Listen, what does he say about Pearl Harbor?"
"President Tugwell is so smart that he has all the ships out to sea, so the U.S. fleet isn't destroyed."
"I see."
"So there really isn't any Pearl Harbor. They attack, but all they get is some little boats."
"It's called the Grasshopper something?"
"The Grasshopper lies heavy. That's a quote from the Bible."
"And Japan is defeated because there's no Pearl Harbor. Listen, Japan would have won anyhow, even if there had been no Pearl Harbor."
"The U.S. fleet, in his book, keeps them from taking the Philippines and Australia."
"They would have taken them anyhow. Their fleet was superior. I know the Japanese fairly well, and it was their destiny to assume dominance in the Pacific. The U.S. was on the decline ever since World War I. Every country on the Allied side was ruined in that war, morally and spiritually."
With stubbornness, the girl said,
"And if the Germans hadn't taken Malta, Churchill would have stayed in power and guided England to victory."
"How? Where?"
"In North Africa. Churchill would have defeated Rommel, finally."
Wyndham Matson guffawed.
"And once the British had defeated Rommel, they could move their whole army back and up through Turkey to join remnants of Russian armies and make a stand. In the book, they halt the Germans' eastward advance into Russia at some town on the Volga. We never heard of this town, but it really exists because I looked it up in the Atlas."
"What's it called?"
"Stalingrad. And the British turned the tide of the war there. So in the book, Rommel never would have linked up with those German armies that came down from Russia, von Paulus's armies, remember? And the Germans never would have been able to go on into the Middle East and get the needed oil, or go into India like they did and link up with the Japanese, and..."
"No strategy on earth could have defeated Erwin Rommel," Wyndham Matson stated. "And no events like this guy dreamed up, this town in Russia very heroically called Stalingrad, no holding action could have done any more than delay the outcome. It couldn't have changed it. Listen, I met Rommel in New York when I was there on business in 1948.
Actually, he had only seen the military governor of the USA at a reception in the White House, and at a distance.
"What a man! What dignity and bearing! So I know what I'm talking about," he wound up.
"It was a dreadful thing," Rita said, "when General Rommel was relieved of his post and that awful Lammers was appointed in his place. That's when that murdering in those concentration camps really began."
"They existed when Rommel was military governor."
"But," she gestured, "it wasn't official. Maybe those SS hoodlums did those acts then, but he wasn't like the rest of them. He was more like those old Prussians. He was harsh.
I'll tell you who really did a good job in the USA, Wyndham Matson said. Who you can look to for the economic revival. Albert Speer. Not Rommel and not the organization Tott. Speer was the best appointment the Partei made in North America. He got all those businesses and corporations and factories, everything, going again, and on an efficient basis. I wish we had that out here. As it is, we've got 5 outfits competing in each field, and a terrific waste. There's nothing more foolish than economic competition.
Rita said, I couldn't live in those work camps, those dorms they have back east. A girlfriend of mine, she lived there. They censored her mail. She couldn't tell me about it until she moved back out here again. They had to get up at 6:30 in the morning to band music.
You'd get used to it. You'd have clean quarters, adequate food, recreation, medical care provided. What do you want, egg in your beer?
Through the cool night fog of San Francisco, his big German-made car moved quietly. On the floor, Mr. Tagomi sat, his legs folded beneath him. He held a handleless cup of oolong tea, into which he blew now and then as he smiled up at Mr. Baines.
You have a lovely place here, Baines said presently. There is a peacefulness here on the Pacific coast. It is completely different from back there. He did not specify.
God speaks to man in the sign of the arousing, Mr. Tagomi murmured.
Pardon?
The oracle. I'm sorry. Fleece-seeking cortical response.
Wool-gathering, Baines thought. That's the idiom he means. To himself he smiled.
We are absurd, Mr. Tagomi said, because we live by a 5,000-year-old book. We set it questions, as if it were alive. It is alive, as is the Christian Bible. Many books are actually alive. Not in metaphoric fashion. Spirit animates it. Do you see?
He inspected Mr. Baines' face for his reaction. Carefully phrasing his words, Baines said,
I just don't know enough about religion. It's out of my field. I prefer to stick to subjects I have some competence in.
As a matter of fact, he was not certain what Mr. Tagomi was talking about. I must be tired, Mr. Baines thought. There has been, since I got here this evening, a sort of gnomish quality about everything, a smaller-than-life quality, with a dash of the droll. What is this 5,000-year-old book? The Mickey Mouse watch, Mr. Tagomi himself, the fragile cup in Mr. Tagomi's hand, and on the wall facing Mr. Baines, an enormous buffalo head, ugly and menacing.
What is that head? He asked suddenly.
That, Mr. Tagomi said, is nothing less than creature which sustained the aboriginal in bygone days.
I see.
Shall I demonstrate art of buffalo slaying?
Mr. Tagomi put his cup down on the table and rose to his feet. Here in his own home, in the evening, he wore a silk robe, slippers, and white cravat.
Here I am aboard Iron Horse.
He squatted in the air.
A cross-lap, trusted Winchester rifle 1866 issue from my collection.
He glanced inquiringly at Mr. Baines.
You are travel-stained, sir?
Afraid so, Baines said. It is all a little overwhelming for me. A lot of business worries.
And other worries, he thought. His head ached. He wondered if the fine I.G. Farben analgesics were available here on the Pacific coast. He had become accustomed to them for his sinus headaches.
We must all have faith in something, Mr. Tagomi said. We cannot know the answers. We cannot see ahead on our own.
Mr. Baines nodded.
My wife may have something for your head, Mr. Tagomi said,
seeing him remove his glasses and rub his forehead.
Eye muscles causing pain. Pardon me.
Bowing, he left the room. What I need is sleep, Baines thought, a night's rest. Or is it that I'm not facing the situation, shrinking because it is hard? When Mr. Tagomi returned, carrying a glass of water and some sort of pill, Mr. Baines said,
I really am going to have to say good night and get to my hotel room. But I want to find out something first. We can discuss it further tomorrow, if that's convenient with you. Have you been told about a third party who is to join us in our discussions?
Mr. Tagomi's face registered surprise for an instant. Then the surprise vanished, and he assumed a careless expression.
There was nothing said to that effect.
However, it is interesting, of course.
From the home islands.
Ah, Mr. Takomi said, and this time the surprise did not appear at all. It was totally controlled.
An elderly retired businessman, Mr. Bain said, who is journeying by ship. He has been on his way for 2 weeks now. He has a prejudice against air travel.
The quaint elderly, Mr. Takomi said.
His interests keep him informed as to the home islands markets. He will be able to give us information, and he was coming to San Francisco for a vacation in any case. It is not terribly important, but it will make our talks more accurate.
Yes, Mr. Takomi said. He can correct errors regarding home market. I have been away 2 years.
Did you want to give me that pill?
Starting, Mr. Takomi glanced down, saw that he still held the pill and water. Excuse me. This is powerful, called Zyrcane, manufactured by drug firm in District of China.
As he held his palm out, he added,
non-habit forming.
This old person, Mr. Bain said as he prepared to take the pill, will probably contact your trade mission direct. I will write down his name so that your people will know not to turn him away. I have not met him, but I understand he's a little deaf and a little eccentric. We want to be sure he doesn't become miffed. Mr. Takomi seemed to understand. He loves rhododendrons. He'll be happy if you can provide someone to talk to him about them for half an hour or so while we arrange our meeting. His name, I will write it down. Taking his pill, he got out his pen and wrote.
Mr. Shinjiro Yatabe,
Mr. Takomi read, accepting the slip of paper. He dutifully put it away in his pocketbook. One more point. Mr. Takomi slowly picked at the rim of his cup, listening. A delicate trifle. The old gentleman, it is embarrassing. He is almost 80. Some of his ventures, toward the end of his career, were not successful. Do you see?
He is not well off any longer, Mr. Takomi said, and perhaps he draws a pension.
That is it, and the pension is painfully small. He therefore augments it by means here and there.
A violation of some petty ordinance, Mr. Takomi said. The home government and its bureaucratic officialdom. I grasp the situation. The old gentleman receives a stipend for his consultation with us, and he does not report it to his pension board, so we must not reveal his visit. They are only aware that he takes a vacation.
You are a sophisticate, Mr. Bain said.
Mr. Takomi said, this situation has occurred before. We have not in our society solved the problem of the aged, more of which persons occur constantly as medical measures improve. China teaches us rightly to honor the old. However, the Germans cause our neglect to seem close to outright virtue. I understand they murder the old.
The Germans, Baines murmured, again rubbing his forehead. Had the pill had an effect, he felt a little drowsy.
Being from Scandinavia, you no doubt have had much contact with Festung Europa. For instance, you embarked at Tempelhof. Can one take an attitude like this? You are a neutral. Give me your opinion, if you will.
I don't understand what attitude you mean, Mr. Baines said.
Toward the old, the sick, the feeble, the insane, the useless in all variations. Of what use is a newborn baby? Some Anglo-Saxon philosopher reputedly asked. I have committed that utterance to memory and contemplated it many times. Sir, there is no use, in general.
Mr. Baines murmured some sound or other. He made it the noise of a non-committal politeness.
Isn't it true, Mr. Takomi said, that no man should be the instrument for another's needs?
He leaned forward urgently.
Please give me your neutral Scandinavian opinion.
I don't know, Mr. Bain said.
During the war, Mr. Takomi said, I held minor post in District of China, in Shanghai. There at Hangqiu, a settlement of Jews, interned by imperial government for duration, kept alive by joint relief. The Nazi minister at Shanghai requested we massacre the Jews. I recall my superior's answer. It was, such is not in accord with humanitarian considerations. They rejected the request as barbaric. It impressed me.
I see, Mr. Baines murmured. Is he trying to draw me out? He asked himself. Now he felt alert. His wits seemed to come together.
The Jews, Mr. Tagomi said, were described always by the Nazis as Asian and non-white. Sir, the implication was never lost on personages in Japan, even among the War Cabinet. I have not ever discussed this with Reich citizens whom I have encountered, Mr. Baines interrupted.
Well, I'm not a German, so I can hardly speak for Germany. Standing, he moved toward the door.
I will resume the discussion with you tomorrow. Please excuse me, I cannot think.
But as a matter of fact, his thoughts were now completely clear. I have to get out of here, he realized. This man is pushing me too far.
Forgive stupidity of fanaticism, Mr. Tagomi said, at once moving to open the door. Philosophical involvement blinded me to authentic human fact. Here.
He called something in Japanese, and the front door opened. A young Japanese appeared, bowing slightly, glancing at Mr. Baines. My driver, Mr. Baines thought. Perhaps my quixotic remarks on the Lufthansa flight, he thought suddenly. To that, whatever his name was, Lotze, got back to the Japanese here somehow. Some connection. I wish I hadn't said that to Lotze, he thought. I regret, but it's too late. I am not the right person, not at all, not for this. But then he thought, a Swede would say that to Lotze. It is all right. Nothing has gone wrong. I am being overly scrupulous, carrying the habits of the previous situation into this. Actually, I can do a good deal of open talking. That is the fact I have to adapt to. And yet, his conditioning was absolutely against it. The blood in his veins, his bones, his organs rebelled. Open your mouth, he said to himself. Something, anything, an opinion. You must if you are to succeed. He said, perhaps they are driven by some desperate subconscious archetype, in the Jungian sense. Mr. Tagomi nodded.
I have read Jung. I understand.
They shook hands. I'll telephone you tomorrow morning, Mr. Baines said. Good night, sir. He bowed, and so did Mr. Tagomi. The young, smiling Japanese, stepping forward, said something to Mr. Baines which he could not understand. Eh? Baines said, as he gathered up his overcoat and stepped out onto the porch.
Mr. Tagomi said, he is addressing you in Swedish, sir. He has taken a course at Tokyo University on the 30 Years' War and is fascinated by your great hero, Gustavus Adolphus.
Mr. Tagomi smiled sympathetically.
However, it is plain that his attempts to master so alien a linguistic have been hopeless. No doubt he uses one of those phonograph record courses. He is a student, and such courses, being cheap, are quite popular with students.
The young Japanese, obviously not understanding English, bowed and smiled. I see, Baines murmured. Well, I wish him luck. I have my own linguistic problems, he thought, evidently. Good Lord, the young Japanese student, while driving him to his hotel, would no doubt attempt to converse with him in Swedish the entire way, a language which Mr. Baines barely understood, and then only when it was spoken in the most formal and correct manner, certainly not when attempted by a young Japanese who tried to pick it up from a phonograph record course. He'll never get through to me, Mr. Baines thought, and he'll keep trying, because this is his chance. Probably he will never see a Swede again. Mr. Baines groaned inwardly. What an ordeal it was going to be, for both of them.